This episode is brought to you by Navy Federal Credit Union. At Navy Federal, it's been the mission to help the military community for over 90 years. And not just help them, but do everything to make sure they not only grow, but flourish. That's why Navy Federal Credit Union has all kinds of great savings and investment options, like share certificates with sky-high rates. So don't hesitate. Start growing your finances today with a variety of savings and investment options. Navy Federal Credit Union. Our members are the mission. Savings products insured by NCUA. Investment products are not insured, not obligations of Navy Federal and may lose value.
If you own a vehicle with less than 200,000 miles and have an auto warranty about to expire or no warranty coverage at all, listen up. CarShield has a low-cost, month-to-month vehicle protection plan that covers more parts than ever. Visit carshield.com/audio to find out how you could pay almost nothing for covered auto repairs. Drivers who activate this vehicle protection today will also receive free roadside assistance, free towing, and car rental options at no additional cost. Get your free quote today at carshield.com/audio. That's carshield.com/audio.
Hey everyone, it's Ted from Consumer Cellular, the guy in the orange sweater, and this is your wake-up call. If you're paying too much for wireless service, you don't have to keep having that nightmare. Consumer Cellular has the same fast, reliable coverage as the leading carriers for less. And for a limited time, new customers receive their second month free when they sign up and use promo code MONTHFREE by May 31st. So why keep spending more than you have to? Seriously, wake up and call 1-888-FREEDOM or visit ConsumerCellular.com.
Taxes, fees, and other third-party charges will apply. See website for additional details.
This is Wins and Losses with Clay Travis. Clay talks with the most entertaining people in sports, entertainment, and business. Now, here's Clay Travis.
Welcome in. Appreciate all of you listening to us, the Wins and Losses podcast. I am Clay Travis, and we are about to be joined by Megan Kelly, who has had a really impressive media career. She also fled the law as quickly probably as she could. I'm actually curious. I read quite a bit about her practice of law in her most recent book, but we're going to run through a bunch of different stories. But beginning right off the top here, Megan, thanks for joining us. And was leaving the practice of law the best decision you ever made in your career?
It was definitely one of them. It wasn't that easy at the time, but yes, in retrospect, for sure. By the way, thank you for having me. So you know how it is when you become a lawyer or anything that requires a bunch of schooling, right? So it's a lot of money and a lot of time. Your ego gets attached to it. And
yes.
I had worked my tail off. I was at a big, well-respected firm, Jones Day, which I loved. And I was about to make partner. I was there 9 years. I practiced law 9 years. And was about to make partner. And that was a feather that I wanted in my cap. You know, I felt I had earned it. And I don't remember my 20s because I was at the office the entire time. And I really felt like I should stay long enough to get that feather. But then I just got honest with myself and realized I was miserable. You know, they say the law is a jealous mistress. And, you know, my mistress was so needy. She was calling constantly. She never gave me a weekend off. And I wanted my mistress to go away. So finally, I did find, you know, the resolve to get out, and I never looked back. You know, it's just the parts of the practice of law I do miss, but the overall lifestyle, I don't miss one bit.
So I want to just kind of dive into that because we have a lot of lawyers who listen to this show, and you hit on several different interesting angles there that I find to be fascinating. And I want to start with the first one. One of the pratfalls, I would say, of having success is people look at you like you're crazy when you decide to do something else. And I, people who kind of know my story and are listening, I practiced law for a couple of years, and I remember I started at 25. I had what I call a quarter-life crisis, and I was looking around the office, and I was like, oh my God, this could be the next 50 years of my life being a litigator. And I was like, this is not what I love. It's slow moving. I don't like the procedural aspects of the law. I don't really enjoy writing over the same issues, arguing about things that I don't really care about, frankly. And so I ended up, like, writing was my escape, writing about sports, which led into radio, which led into TV. For you, was there a moment in your career where you had sort of an epiphany and you thought, this is not for me, even though, like you said, you're about to be partner, you're being very successful, you're making a lot of money, what I call the golden handcuffs very often of being a lawyer, where yep. You can't quite find the will to escape. What was it for you that was that final impetus or epiphany, or was there one, or was it a gradual process?
Well, there was a moment, an aha moment. But, you know, like you, I know you had a middle-class background, and so did I. And so, and I put myself through law school, so I had a bunch of debt. And I had never seen or even dreamed of money like they were paying me. You know, it was,
right.
It felt like a fortune and one that I could never rebuild if I left the firm. I mean, just, I was so proud of myself, you know, for making good and earning real money on my own, paying back my law school debt. And I just thought, who am I if I'm not Megyn Kelly Esquire? I'm not sure who I am or whether I could ever achieve this level of success. And of course, the firm pulled me aside and kind of telegraphed, you'll never achieve this level of success if you leave. You know, you, a great guy who I love at Jones Day pulled me aside. He was in the issues and appeals department, which is very erudite. And he said, MK, he said, no matter how good you are at whatever else you intend to do, you will never be as good at that as you are at the practice of law. You don't leave. And, you know, you've got really smart people saying things like that to you. You think, shit, like I shouldn't go. Like I, but with all that in mind, there was one night I was in Chicago and I was driving home in the Kennedy one night at 2 a.m. yet again. And just tears were streaming down my face because I was exhausted. As you know, the practice of law is incredibly acrimonious. I was a litigator, so, you know, constant fighting, and it's really, it's just snake pit fighting. And I was just stressed out, and I'd missed funerals, I'd missed weddings, and I thought, maybe I could just go off the road and break a femur. Like, if I broke a femur, then I'd have to be in the hospital, like, for a while. It can't just be, like, a rib, because I'll have to go back to work soon.
It's wild that lawyers think like that, but you sometimes do start to think, man, if I just had an illness that I know I could get over, but, you know, like, it wasn't that bad, but I couldn't work for a couple of weeks. Like, but when you start thinking, if I could break a leg, I could have a little bit more time to myself. It's kind of a sign that maybe you don't have the perfect work-life balance, right?
Right, right. And it's like you finally get to the point where you're like, I don't care anymore. I went to visit my friend who worked in Boston as a nurse at or around that time, and she had no money. And we'd gone to high school together. We were always close friends. And she was so happy. She was living in a crappy one-bedroom walk-up, and we went to the corner bar. We had a couple of beers for like a buck each. You know, contrasted to my life in Chicago with the big fancy martinis and the steak dinners and the nice purse, you know. And she was so happy, and I was so happy with her. It was just a reminder that I really didn't need all those trappings at all. You know, they were just window dressing around a life that I wasn't enjoying. And so those two things kind of got me to the point where I was like, all right, I got to get out. And now the big question is, what the hell else can I do?
Yeah, so you mentioned the way that you approach the law if you come from a middle-class background. I remember as a second-year summer associate, I was working in downtown Nashville where I grew up. My dad was in another building. He was a lifelong state employee. And I was making more money as a summer associate at 23 years old or whatever the heck I was than he was at, you know, 63 or 64 years old approaching retirement age. And I remember him coming into that building and seeing the office and everything else. And there are those trappings of success, right? If you never have experienced them before, it can feel a little bit constraining to even think, oh, I'm going to leave and try something else. But yet almost every lawyer you talk to has a parachute plan, right? They have something they would do if they weren't practicing law. And so many of them get wrapped up. So you make the decision to try something else, and you eventually are going to get into working in journalism and doing reporting and being on television. What made you think that you would be good at that? And did you have any other things or aspirations that you also considered exploring when you decided to leave?
So I confess I had nothing other than journalism that I thought about. I had... In high school, I had thought perhaps I want to be a journalist. I took one of those aptitude tests, or one of those tests that says, this is what you should be. And it said journalist. And I thought, oh, okay, well, that's interesting. I like to write. I like to read. I like to tell stories. But I kind of, I don't know, I did a couple-day internship with the Albany Times Union, my local paper. I'm from Albany, New York. And a couple of other small things. And then I went to Syracuse, though not to the journalism school. I couldn't get in there. I went for poli-sci, and I took a bunch of classes at Newhouse, and I liked it. But then I just got sidetracked with the whole law thing. And so when I decided to leave the law, it was a natural next step to consider. And what I realized was, and I'm sure you and a lot of your listeners who are lawyers understand this, I hadn't exactly been preparing for journalism, but I had, in the way you see in The Karate Kid with the wax on and wax off, been learning skills that would make me very good at next profession, if so long as I chose wisely. You know, there are a lot of skills you learn in law school and in the practice of law that are very transferable in helpful ways to other jobs. And one of the things I loved through law school and as a litigator was getting up on my feet and making an argument. I loved that. I loved being on and having the pressure of real people looking at me, and in the case of a judge, testing me, in the case of a jury, needing to be persuaded in easy-to-understand terms and to see if I could do it. You know, and in the law, you really do have to have a foothold, at least in the facts. Unlike journalism today,
yes.
You kind of have to stick with the record. And that's a challenge, right? You might have bad facts, and you got to find a way through them. I loved all that. I hated interrogatories. I hated the acrimony. I wasn't too keen on, like, the really nasty depositions. But I loved arguing in front of courts of appeal. I loved all the trials I did. It was, like, that stuff. And so I just thought, all those skills are going to translate for me in journalism. So when I first started, I stunk. But I knew eventually I could be good if I just kept practicing.
When you say you stunk, what does that mean? You know, for people out there who haven't ever thought about the discipline of being an on-air reporter, did you go back and watch yourself? What were you doing poorly? And how did you get the opportunity to even find out that you stunk? What did you have to do? And how much, I'm always fascinated by this, how much of a pay cut, I know this is in your book, but how much of a pay cut did you have to take to move from nearly being a partner at one of the elite law firms in the country to basically starting all over again as a journalist?
Oh, I mean, it was huge. I was approaching a seven-figure deal, and I took a job that paid $17,000 a year when I left. So it was. I mean, I wasn't making seven figures, so it would have been a big
yes.
hike had I made partner. But.
But there's a big drop from several hundred thousand dollars a year-ish to $17,000 a year that most people, frankly, wouldn't take no matter what.
That's right. And you really do have to slam face first into the wall of unhappiness, I think, to make that leap. At least that's what it took for me. You know, thinking about harming yourself, like that's more than a red flag. You know, that's a five-alarm fire kind of flag.
Yes.
So, you know, what happened with my evolution in terms of like growing and getting my feet, you know, under me was I had a buddy who, she was in my guitar class and she offered to help me make a resume tape, which I'd never even heard of. I didn't understand. I was like, don't I just have to tell him that I'm about to make partner at a big law firm? She's like, no one's going to give a damn about that. She was right. No one even wanted to see a paper resume. They just wanted to see a tape of you on camera delivering. It can be fake news, but just they just want to see how you penetrate the lens. So she helped me make it. And the guy who shot the tape for me agreed to hook me up with his professor at this local college in Chicago. And that professor let me audit his journalism class. So I went there every Wednesday night after I left Jones Day. And I was like the old lady. At that point, I was like 30, 31 with all these, you know, 20, 19-year-olds. I was like, isn't learning fun, kids? You know? and I was loving it. I'm learning all about this new profession that I'm considering. And we'd have to go down on the streets of Chicago. So there I'd be on South Michigan Avenue in the blustery cold weather at 8 p.m. doing fake news reporting into this professor's sort of real-looking TV camera. And you couldn't stop. You had to do a minute-long report. You had to nail it. You know, you couldn't. You had to treat it like it was a live shot. And it was thrilling. And all I could think was, this is what I want to do. And please, God, don't let anyone from Jones Day walk by right now.
When do you actually confess to the partners and the people that you worked for and with at Jones Day that you were exploring in a serious way journalism? Like, how far into the process did you get before you were like, hey, this is, you know, not guitar lessons that I'm just doing on the side. This is something that maybe I have an interest in.
So I kind of got discouraged. There I was with my resume tape thinking, okay, great, but I don't have a single connection, you know, in news. I don't have anything on my resume to suggest I could do news. You know, I just had that feeling that I'm sure a lot of people get, which is just apathy and self-doubt and, you know, the desire to stay on my couch. And by the way, my therapist always says the desire to stay on one's couch should always be fought. Like that retreat is bad. It's almost always bad. And one day I was watching Lifetime Television, Clay, and they ran this movie, this, you know, Lifetime movie called The Jessica Savage Story. And she was this amazing journalist back in the late 70s, 80s, who was making it in the man's industry, one of the only women. She was like Jessica and Connie Chung and a young Barbara Walters, and that was it. And it was a great story. It ended in ruination, sadly. But her rise
as most Lifetime stories do. At least she didn't get murdered by her husband.
Right. But I was inspired, you know, to try. So I started cold calling news directors. And every single one was like, bye. You know, no one wanted to talk to me. They didn't want to help me. They didn't want to give me a chance. And finally, I got smart, and I decided to walk my tape into the news station in D.C., WJLA. And they had a cable channel that was like their sister, and I thought, maybe they'll pop me on that cable channel that, like, not a lot of people are watching. I got a shot there. And I went in, and I met this guy, Bill Lord, who was the news director for both. And God bless that guy. He put me on the air. So we started just one day a week. And at that point, I had to disclose to Jones Day that I was doing this because, A, they might see me, and B, you could create an ethical, you know, conflict depending on what I was reporting on. So I sort of said, it's just going to be fun. I just want to try it out. And they were a little leery but said, okay, do it. And then I was doing pretty well, and Bill Lord said, well, how about you do 2 days a week? So I did Saturdays and Sundays, and I did the law job the other days. And then they came to me and said, well, how about you do another day a week? And that would have required me to go part-time at Jones Day. And so I went. I spoke with the head of general litigation, a guy named Tim Cullen, who was so great. And he said, MK, I'm sad because this feels like a trial separation, and those usually lead to divorce. And I said, Tim, you know, it very well might, but I got to try. So he let me stay at Jones Day, you know, part-time. And then eventually I decided it was time to make the full-time leap.
All right. So you're how old the first time you go on air with, I think it was WJLA, you said?
So that would have been 2003. So I was 32.
Okay. So you've never really done television before. You're 32 years old. You get to go on this, this relatively small station in Washington, D.C. What did you do the first time that you were on television?
The very first time I ever saw myself on television, it was taped. So I was clear, right? It was a taped piece.
Do you remember the topic of the taped piece? Do you remember what you reported
on? I do.
On?
It was, well, the very first thing I ever did was on a hurricane. And it was Hurricane Isabel that had gone through Virginia. And I thought for sure, I was going to be doing mostly legal stuff because that had been my pitch. And I remember calling Bill Lord because my first day was a Friday. And I was like, probably don't need me, right? Because the storms come in and, you know, you're not going to need a lawyer, legal expert type. And he goes, if you don't already have rain boots and rain pants and rain slicker, you better go get them and get in here. I'm like, oh no. And so it was a crazy night. And I did a report on, and not that night, but the next day on the hurricane, and it was fine. But the first time I had to do a live shot where it's like, go, you know, like I'd practiced on the streets of Chicago, was at Dulles Airport. And there was something going on with the airport and security, and they had a scare. You know, this is back when we were still pretty close to 9/11, and there was a scare every other day. And it was deer in the headlights, you know, and they're like, you can hear the anchor toss to you. And really, I'm like, I don't know who the hell I am. Who the hell am I? Just say your name. Say something resembling anything. And I got through it, and I thought I had been totally incomprehensible. When I looked back at it later, it was okay. It wasn't hideous, but it was terrifying.
Be sure to catch live editions of Outkick, the coverage with Clay Travis, weekdays at 6 a.m. Eastern, 3 a.m. Pacific.
Like many of us, you might think identity theft will never happen to you. But consider this. There's a new identity theft victim every 3 seconds in the U.S. That's over 15 million people by the end of this year, equal to the populations of New York, Los Angeles, and Chicago combined. Even worse, identity theft victims often don't even know they're victims. That's why LifeLock Identity Theft Protection alerts you to identity threats, even the ones that don't show up on a credit report, like data breaches, fraudulent bank transactions, loan and credit card applications, and crimes committed in your name. If your identity is stolen, your own dedicated LifeLock U.S.-based restoration specialist will work to fix it. LifeLock protects you in ways that you simply can't on your own. Join now and save up to 25% your first year at LifeLock.com/news. That's LifeLock.com/news to save up to 25%. Identity theft protection starts here.
This episode is brought to you by Navy Federal Credit Union. At Navy Federal, it's been the mission to help the military community for over 90 years. And not just help them, but do everything to make sure they not only grow, but flourish. That's why Navy Federal Credit Union has all kinds of great savings and investment options, like share certificates with sky-high rates. So don't hesitate. Start growing your finances today with a variety of savings and investment options. Navy Federal Credit Union. Our members are the mission. Savings products insured by NCUA. Investment products are not insured, not obligations of Navy Federal and may lose value.
Hey everyone, it's Ted from Consumer Cellular, the guy in the orange sweater, and this is your wake-up call. If you're paying too much for wireless service, you don't have to keep having that nightmare. Consumer Cellular has the same fast, reliable coverage as the leading carriers for less. And for a limited time, new customers receive their second month free when they sign up and use promo code MONTHFREE by May 31st. So why keep spending more than you have to? Seriously, wake up and call 1-888-FREEDOM or visit ConsumerCellular.com.
Taxes, fees, and other third-party charges will apply. See website for additional details.
I'm Clay Travis. This is Wins and Losses. We're talking with Megan Kelly. So do you go back like an athlete and study your early tapes in television to figure out what you're doing well? Or did you find that you kind of got a sense for how you were doing? What about the discipline of television came to you, and how did you get better?
I definitely went back and looked at the tapes. And I think that's a must do, you know, because it is a visual medium and you have to see, or whatever the mechanism is, listen to yourself and see what works and what doesn't work. You know, you may think you sound fine. When you go back and you watch yourself, you see a totally different product. So I did that for years when I first started, you know, at WJLA and then at Fox News. But the truth is, that is a skill you only develop by doing it over and over and over. You know, it's like typing. And you cannot type 70 words a minute before you've done 20, 30, 40, and so on. So I would just say yes to everything, which I think every young person in a job should do. I mean, I always tell the young people who are asking me for advice, you know, if they want you to empty the trash, empty the trash. Like, say yes to every weekend shift, to working on Christmas. You know, have some gumption. Go after it. You know, don't be a I'm above this kind of person. And that leads to opportunity, you know, because the sad truth is it will set you apart from 90% of your competition. So it just happened to be, and in my profession as it is in most, that makes you better. You know, you get your 10,000 hours in, and before you know it, you're doing it almost effortlessly.
What I have found is, and this is probably a legal background as well, what I get to do now is make arguments. But instead of having to take, as you said earlier, sometimes you're on the wrong side of an argument. You're like, boy, I'd rather have the facts of that other side. Now, you know, with the position that I'm in, and I think you get to do this now as well, you get to look at all the facts, array them as you see fit, and then make your case. And as you were talking about your legal career, it struck me having watched your television show, basically what you're doing is arguing in front of a jury every single night about cases and stories that matter the most to you in a compelling fashion, right? It's basically like an oral argument that you get to make every single night when you're doing a live television show.
Absolutely. And one of the biggest challenges, but also rewards if you do it right, of doing that show in that way was taking really condensed, difficult subjects and condensing them in a way that my imaginary viewer, the one I picture in my head, you know,
yes.
She's working on
who do you picture, by the way? Who do you picture? Because I do that for my radio show, my television show, too. An average person who's watching. Who in your mind is an average Megyn Kelly viewer?
I have a woman in my head named Madge who lives in Iowa. She works all day. She's got a couple of kids. And she and her husband come home from working at night. And they turn on the TV. Maybe they have a glass of wine. And they want to consume their news in a way that is easy to understand, somewhat entertaining, trustworthy, and that they don't have to work too hard to get. So it's my job to take something hugely complex, like a Supreme Court ruling on redistricting, and try to make Madge not have to work for it at all. If
yes.
Madge has to hit the rewind button on the remote control, I have failed. It's like cool water going over a hot brain. That's how I want my news delivery to feel to the consumer. And if you have to try too hard on the air, you haven't tried hard enough prior to getting to air. But I will say, Clay, one of the things I like about you, and one of the things I think may be the solution to our entirely disgustingly broken media, is more lawyers delivering the news.
Yeah.
In whatever way works for them. Because lawyers, I think in their soul, they're programmed to understand at least both sides and to
yeah.
try in some way to recognize the other argument. I do, and I don't know if it's just that we're soulless hacks or, you know, these trained elite arguers. The latter sounds better, but whatever it is, most lawyers I know, Dan Abrams is another, they're really good at being fair.
I don't think there's any doubt at all. I mean, what I always say on my show is I care about three things, the facts, the facts, the facts. And one of the things that troubles me the most about our country today is you can disagree with my opinions or your opinions or anybody's opinion out there in the world of media or your friends and family posting on social media all day. But if you start with incorrect facts, then you get to a place with an incorrect opinion. And so there's a lot of people who don't care about the factual basis, whether you're Democrat, Republican, independent. And it seems like we have lost that, particularly in a social media age. And I do think lawyers are better attuned to being able to consider both sides of an issue and at least understand the importance of facts. Because what you're talking about is basically the skills of a great trial lawyer. And a great trial lawyer can take facts, which are honest and accurate, and put the best spin possible on them to advocate for the cause they believe in. But they know that the facts have to be right or the jury's not going to trust them, right? Face to face.
Right.
It seems to me we've lost the ability to recognize the foundational basis of fact.
It's one of the things that is most disturbing me and most inspiring me to get back out there, because both sides do it, right? You know, President Trump, I always say he doesn't have an adult relationship with the truth. You know,
yeah.
I think all of his years in real estate sort of led him to tolerate a certain level of, puffery, we would have called it in the law. And so he is, I think, by nature, an optimist who tries to oversell positive outcomes. But he also, if he gets himself in trouble, he's not just going to level with you about what he did and why it wasn't a big deal. He's going to try to tell you the facts are other than what they are. That's a character trait that he has, for better or for worse. But on the left, you see like a post-factual world when it comes to discussions on tough subjects, you know, like the transgender issue and the gender issue in general, you know, that there's no more biological sex and that, you know, having certain genitalia is totally irrelevant to whether you're a woman or a man. I don't believe that's true scientifically. We can talk
right.
about what your life is like and how you want to be accepted, and I'm totally pro all of that. But there is a basis in science. And I don't like the silencing of the scientific community or even in the, you know, all the Black Lives Matter protests that we saw this summer. You know, you can want to be an advocate against racism without making up lies about the police.
Yes.
And I'm not talking about George Floyd, but I'm talking about the lies that were put out there about the number of cases of police brutality, of police killings of black men. There are real data on that, and they've been either suppressed.
They're silenced.
Or
in fact,
I've got
it right here. I mean, that I keep because it's been such a big topic in the world of sports. You know, a police officer is 17 and a half times as likely to be killed by a black potential suspect as a police officer is to kill an unarmed black man in this country, right? That's a fact. I'm reading directly from the Wall Street Journal. The data is clear and transparent and straightforward. That is factual basis. Now, we can talk once we have those facts in place about ways to make the country better based on our relationship between police and those that they consider suspects of crimes, whatever race they might be, right? To try to dial down the tension. But it's as if that fact makes people uncomfortable. And so you can't even have an honest conversation about how to fix things if you can't begin with a common basis of fact.
That's right, because they'll call you a racist. And
that's
no
right.
one wants to be called a racist. And it's sad because, look, I'm sort of a free agent now, right? So it's like I don't really care what they call me. And they've already called me all the mean names, and I'm doing just fine. But I do worry about civilians, right, for lack of a better term, because they don't want to put themselves out there. I've got good friends who are, you know, they're successful doctors and lawyers, and they can't even like a tweet without having
yes.
to worry about
that's 100%
their
right.
job. And that's not okay. You know, the data on police shootings or killings of black suspects are knowable. They are knowable. It's not a perfect science, but they have been reported for years. The Washington Post has been keeping a running tally of it all. And for some reason, and, you know, people can draw their own conclusions, these activists want us only to look at the percentage of black people in the population, which tends to be around 13%, and then look at the number of black people who are killed by police in a year. And that's just not the relevant data. They don't want you to factor in at all the level of black criminality. And the Wall Street Journal's been doing a great job in reporting the facts on this, but over 50% of the violent crimes in the major cities of this country are committed by black men. Now, the cops are not, they're not arresting women. That doesn't make them sexist against men. They're going
That's right.
after the people who are committing the crime. And so necessarily the interactions between those guys and police, they're going to go up, and they're fraught because if you resist arrest, and the data show that that's what's happened in virtually all these cases where a death results, your odds of getting injured or killed by the police officer go up exponentially.
That's an argument that is all factual based, right? I think it's an important one that needs to be discussed in the country. You couldn't say that on CNN today. You couldn't say that today on MSNBC, right? I really don't think you could.
No. No.
Why do you think, and you worked and had your own show and you did had a tremendous success at Fox News. Why do you think our society, media culture, has created this world where there are facts that aren't allowed to be spoken on television on certain mm-hmm. networks? And by the way, you can make it across the board, right? There are facts probably that make Fox News viewers uncomfortable that don't get shared very often. We don't have a Walter Cronkite of the world who's sitting down and kind of the arbiter that everybody trusts to be a great official, so to speak, of the world at large. How do we put the genie back in the bottle? Can we? Are things going to even get worse from here?
Boy, I mean, I think with what's happening with this sort of woke culture, you know, the social justice warriors, it's going to be tough. That's a small group of Americans. They do not represent the majority in trying to cancel everybody and shut everybody up, but they're really loud. And the media is, they're in complete fealty to that
yes.
small group. And so it's dangerous. And I'll tell you, there are so many intellectuals, black and white, but a lot of black intellectuals who are sort of pushing a more heterodox view, you know, from Glenn Lowry to Coleman Hughes, obviously Shelby Steele, Thomas Sowell. But so you can read black intellectuals who have done all the research on this and see what their worldview is. It would back up everything I just said, right? Go read Jason Riley in the Wall Street Journal if you want to know the facts. But if a white person says it, they're going to call you a racist. So you just, you know, to really know what's going on, you have to actually be prepared to take some, you know, some punches in the face. But I think what's happened with the media is they're left. They're not just liberal. They're leftist. And they love to virtue signal. You know, early on in my career, I got sent down to cover the Duke, what we now know is the fake rape case with the lacrosse.
Yeah, the Duke lacrosse case. Yes.
Yep. And I went down. When I first heard about that case, I was new to Fox. It was like 2005. And I, at the time, I was 34, so I was, whatever, not that far out of college. And I was like, these guys, they probably did it. You know, like the cross players and, you know, they
You had preconceived stereotypes as a, you know, girl who had gone to Syracuse. You're like, oh, I can see these stupid lacrosse guys doing something like this.
Of course, 100%.
By the way, everybody does. And then one of the great things about being a lawyer is you end up representing people that you're like, man, this guy seems like a total jerk. And then you start to look at the facts and you're like, man, maybe this is not very similar at all to what was initially reported. So that's fast. So you go down to Duke, and when do you start to have doubts about that case as a lawyer and you start to look at it because you're in a unique position there?
Well, I'll tell you, the first thing that happened before I left for North Carolina was Britt Hume, my boss in the D.C. Bureau, said, keep an open mind. And it was just a small piece of advice, but it was the best advice, right? Because it's just a good reminder that it really isn't about what I think. It's about where the facts lead. And I'm going down there on a fact-finding mission. So that's what I did. I went down, and Fox gave me the, you know, latitude to develop sources. Normally, they just have you tethered to a camera. We have to do a live shot every half hour on a big story like that. But they sent a different reporter to do that so I could actually develop facts. And it was very clear, if you just had an open mind, the facts did not support this woman's allegations. Her story started to fall apart very early. And I reported those, you know, inconsistencies in her story and so on. And at the time, this is very early in my career, people were suggesting it was racist of me and even sexist of me to be, quote, siding with these three white privileged guys instead of this single mother, black person who lived on sort of the Durham side as opposed to the Duke side. You know, it's like there's two areas of Durham, one's less affluent than the other. And I just had to forge through that. You just had to say, okay, they're going to call me names, but I have to report the news. That's what I'm mainly paid to do. And you know who the other person was who was getting the facts right, who was on cable news at that time? Dan Abrams, who I mentioned earlier, a lawyer who came to MSNBC at the time from Court TV, and his dad is Floyd Abrams, the famed First Amendment attorney who argued New York Times v. Sullivan. So I just think, you know, being open-minded to the facts helped me land in the right place. And on these cop shootings, that you just have to be open-minded. You have to be open-minded and go where the evidence goes. You know, the Michael Brown case in Ferguson, you know, people should go. Kamala Harris and others are still referring to Michael Brown as a victim, that he was murdered, that he was murdered. He was not murdered. And there were at least five black eyewitnesses who said they saw him turn and run after the officer when the officer, you know, had already been attacked.
Hands up, don't shoot is 100% a proven lie, yet it continues to be propagated.
Well, and that's what we have to beware of now that the media is in full virtue signaling mode. Because what I've noticed with these cases is the media, which again is leftist, it's not just liberal, it's leftist, they will take these incendiary cases, these videos of a white police officer, or even of a black police officer, and they'll say that's racist too if it's a black defendant, and they'll play it over and over. Over and over and over to tell you that all police are brutal and all police are racist and it's systemically racist. And it's so misrepresentative because you could do the same with a white police officer doing this to a white defendant. And that doesn't mean that all police need to be stopped because they must be brutal against everybody either. Because if you look at the numbers of police killings of defendants here in New York City, they in the 70s, they were in the 400s a year. Now they're down to 30 plus in a year. The police are going in the right direction on this stuff. They're aware that they've had problems. But when it comes to race, it's the media that drives the narrative that it's a black-white thing. And they do that for reasons of their own, especially in an election year.
You mentioned earlier, so you're covering Duke lacrosse in 2005. That is before there is actually a social media universe, really. I mean, Facebook is just getting started then. Twitter doesn't exist. That has put, you know, sort of jet fuel or added steroids to what was already a trend line moving in that direction of everybody being able to find their own worldview by turning on their television or just picking up their phones. What was it like for you, I'm curious, as you move up in the world, to go from Megyn Kelly, who's a reporter, right? Like, you're not necessarily giving your own opinions, to making that transition to an opinionist, and how did you do it?
Well, I mean, I think I'm sort of a hybrid. You know, I'm still a journalist, and that's why I was out there anchoring presidential debates for Fox. But I've offered opinion in the fields that I think I have some expertise in, and that's tended to be legal stuff. You know, I mean, I think this whole Black Lives Matter thing started based on a legal case. And I know how to look at a legal case, and I've never gotten one wrong. I've never looked at one of these situations and said, this is how it's going to come out, and been proven wrong on it. And there's a reason for that. You know, I'm an objective juror on this stuff. I will go where the evidence takes me. So that's sort of what I've tried to do. I've tried to sort of hold on to my journalistic integrity. You know, I'm not somebody who'd go out there. I watch somebody like Nicole Wallace on MSNBC. I don't know what she is. She used to work in Republican circles. She's as far from Republican as you can get now. And she's openly saying she's hosting a daytime, quote, news show on MSNBC, but she openly says she's going to vote for Joe Biden. So back in my day, you weren't supposed to do that as a journalist. You didn't announce who you were going to vote for, and you didn't announce whether you were pro-choice or pro-life. And I wouldn't touch those rails either, but I do feel very comfortable correcting the record, even on dicey issues.
What you mentioned the Donald Trump, the debate that you did, which I thought was fantastic and so well managed, but it obviously turned your life upside down. What is your relationship like now, if at all, with President Trump? Have you had any interaction with the White House since? And how did you find him both as a private and a public figure? How much overlap was there in the way he would behave privately versus the way he behaved publicly?
So privately, I before the debate and even ultimately after the debate, have found him utterly charming. you know, you might be surprised. Utterly charming, generous, self-deprecating, effusive and kind, complimentary. I had nothing but kind feelings toward him, and I still have kind feelings toward him. I don't like what he did toward me for those 9 months, and I don't love the way he talks about, you know, some of my fellow citizens these days. You know, he's not careful with his language, and it can be problematic. And I see the flaws that people accuse him of. There's no question he can be thin-skinned and so on. We all have our problems, and his are magnified because he's the president. But professionally, we went through a very tough period together for those 9 months. It wasn't tough for him. It was tough for me. And I hated it. It was really just one of the most challenging things I've been through professionally. And it was one of those things that sort of, there's probably a lesson in it because, you know, I asked tough questions of all the guys that night. The only difference was Trump wouldn't let it go. You know, he made a thing out of it and wouldn't let it go. And ultimately I couldn't get him off my back. You know, Roger Ailes tried and Sean Hannity tried for me and he was tight with Trump. He just wouldn't. He wouldn't back off. I think he was enjoying the storyline. And so finally, the lesson is, it only stopped when I took it in hand myself. And I contacted him through a friend. It was actually Brian Kilmeade, who got a message to him that I wanted to meet with him. And, you know, Roger later said, you should have met on neutral ground. You should have gone to Trump Tower. I was like, Roger, I don't care. I don't care if it looks like I'm pursuing him or I'm in a secondary role. I am. I'm a journalist. The nature of our relationship is, you know, pursuer and pursued. And so we met, and I mean, the conversation was off the record, but the bottom line is I said, please knock it off. You know, you've done this long enough. You made your point. I want you to put me back on the sidelines where I belong. You belong on the playing field, and I belong on the sidelines. Put me back there. No harm done. And he was totally gracious about it. And we've never had a problem since.
Fox Sports Radio has the best sports talk lineup in the nation. Catch all of our shows at foxsportsradio.com. And within the iHeartRadio app, search FSR to listen live.
This episode is brought to you by Navy Federal Credit Union. At Navy Federal, it's been the mission to help the military community for over 90 years. And not just help them, but do everything to make sure they not only grow, but flourish. That's why Navy Federal Credit Union has all kinds of great savings and investment options, like share certificates with sky-high rates. So don't hesitate. Start growing your finances today with a variety of savings and investment options. Navy Federal Credit Union. Our members are the mission. Savings products insured by NCUA. Investment products are not insured, not obligations of Navy Federal and may lose value.
Good sleep should come naturally, and with the new Natural Hybrid mattress, it can. A collaboration between award-winning mattress brand Lisa and home design favorite West Elm, the Natural Hybrid is the culmination of these two companies' shared values: premium materials, meticulous craftsmanship, and sustainable practices. Made with natural latex, responsibly sourced natural wool, and environmentally safe foams, the Natural Hybrid elevates your sleep sanctuary, indulges your senses, and supports a greener tomorrow. Plus, when you purchase the Natural Hybrid, you're also helping fuel Lisa's work with shelters and those in need. Since 2015, Lisa has donated more than 40,000 mattresses to ensure children and families have a safe place to sleep. Don't put off a good night's sleep any longer. Get a Lisa mattress today for a sound sleep tonight. Visit lisa.com/iHeart. That's LEESA.com/iHeart.
What's up, everybody? This is Stephen A. Smith. When I'm not at my day job, First Take, you can find me in my studio hosting the Stephen A. Smith Show podcast. Tune in every Monday, Wednesday, and Friday, at the very least, as I bring you all new episodes that feature the biggest headlines in the world of sports, pop culture, business, and politics. You'll hear my unfiltered opinions on those nauseating Cowboy fans, the chaos in Washington, D.C., and trending topics on social media, as well as my straight shooter interviews with top celebrities and game changers. And I occasionally give out love advice. Yes, it's true. If you want to know my true feelings about something, I'll give it to you straight. So listen to the Stephen A. Smith Show podcast on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
You said earlier in our conversation, I'm Clay Travis, this is Wins and Losses, we're talking with Megyn Kelly, retreat is almost always bad. You left Fox for NBC. Obviously, that didn't work out. Maybe it did, because maybe you're happy where you are now. If you were going back, would you say, hey, I should have stayed at Fox, I could have kept doing that show? Or was leaving Fox like leaving the practice of law for you? You felt like you had done everything you could there and you were ready for another new challenge. And how would you say to people out there who are, you know, trying to weigh decisions that they make in their own career, how did you make that choice? And looking back on it, would you change anything?
You're so smart, Clay. This is why you're doing so well. That's a great question. And it the answer is it was the latter. It was... You know, I don't regret leaving Fox at all. I kind of miss my old show because I think it was a service. I think it was an honest show that you could trust. And if the Kelly File were still on now, I would watch it. You know, and it's one of the reasons why I'm launching this podcast, you know, because I do want to get back to doing the news in a way that I think is fair and illuminating and hopefully fearless. But I don't regret the decision to leave because it was just a combination of things. It had been a rough time with Trump, yes, but that was in the past. But, you know, the Roger Ailes thing changed my life a lot at Fox. And even when it came out that, you know, he really did have this side of him that was really problematic, people found it tough to forgive. You know, not everybody, but, you know, I have dear, dear friends there. Some of my best friends are there. But some people who I really loved and admired just never got over it, you know, that they thought I had turned on him because I didn't support him. And, you know, I couldn't explain it any better than, you know, I had publicly. You know, I too felt loyal to Roger and grateful to him for what he'd done for me over the course of my career. But when faced with a direct question about whether he was capable of doing this to women or not, there was no way I was going to lie. There's just no way I was going to do it. So my life changed a lot there. The dynamic changed. And while it was changing, my life was explosive. it was, you talk about acrimony. You know, I left the law because it was too many hours and it was too acrimonious. Put that on steroids for my time in cable news primetime. You know, O'Reilly told me before I joined the primetime lineup that he said it's a snake pit. And it got it 100%. I've never been told something more true. And so every time somebody would come after me, or somebody in the press or another journalist or Trump or whoever, it would lead to another crisis meeting. You know, the Trump thing had led to armed guards in my life 24/7, people showing up at my apartment. It was dangerous. And we'd lived like that for 9 months. So I was weary, you know, and at the same time, I had three young kids at the time. They were 7, 5, and 3. And I missed them. I missed mothering. And I remember talking to my therapist about it at the time, and he said, you know, he said, look at Chelsea Clinton. She had two parents who were incredibly busy. You know, they weren't there with her every day. She turned out just fine. And I said, I'm not worried about my kids turning out fine. I'm worried about missing it. Yeah. I'm missing the whole thing. I don't see them anymore. I don't see them Monday through Friday because of these hours. You know, I go to work before they get home from school now. And what I'm doing isn't good enough. So there were a lot of tears that year. There was so much stress. And my life was totally joyless. And I thought, once again, despite the fact that I was making a lot of money and offered a lot of money to stay and had a position of influence, it was irrelevant to me. I was running. And I wasn't running to NBC, but I was just running to a different lifestyle. And the reason I went to NBC over anybody else was simply I thought I could do this morning show that would let me then get home to my kids. I could still do the news and get home to my kids. And, you know, that obviously did not work out. And it wasn't well thought out on my part either. But it was a good move to get out. And I did exercise some new muscles there. And I got to interview Vladimir Putin, which is cool. So it wasn't all bad. And the bottom line is now, in, you know, 2020, I am totally engaged with my kids, with my husband, with my personal life, tight friendships now with my friends that had gone unnurtured. I feel well. I feel healthy. I feel happy, you know, as happy as an Irish Catholic living in New York can be. You know, there's a lot of things going against me. And I don't regret it for a minute. I don't regret it for 1 minute.
One of the things that I think is fascinating about becoming a public figure, and obviously you did that, leaving the law, which is a serious job and it's filled with acrimony, but most of the time you're not going to wake up in the morning and people aren't going to be mentioning your name or having a strong opinion about you, is lots of people that you don't know at all and you'll never be able to interact with suddenly have such strong opinions about you. And I find that transition to be utterly fascinating. I've certainly seen it in my life. And I was talking with my wife the other day and she was like, what percentage of the American public do you think has a positive view of you? And I was like, 35%. And she was like, really? Yeah. And I was like, well, I mean, the media, I'm in the media, I'm in the opinion business. I was like, a lot of people like me, but probably more people dislike me because they have kind of a, you know, caricatured version of me because they've heard opinion they don't like and they think about that. And I said, but the truth is, and I'm brought to this because of what you just mentioned, your three young kids. I've got a 12-year-old, a 10-year-old, and a 6-year-old. And I said, really, the only thing I care is what people in my house think about me, because they know me. And then secondarily, people that are close to me and my family, and then people that I work with on a daily basis. I really don't care outside of that. But I'm curious for you, and my wife says, like, that's my superpower. I just genuinely don't care what people I don't know think about me. But I wonder if that's true for you and what it was like to suddenly go from, I would say you got generally favorable press with the Kelly file, to suddenly, and you may disagree with that, but it seemed generally favorable, at least as favorable as somebody who's working at Fox News can get, to suddenly you are just getting attacked on all angles by everyone. And it's like, that had to be wild. What is that experience like to be in the center of the storm like you were and still are to a certain extent, but certainly then you really were?
Well, I mean, that was very stressful. Like, being misrepresented day after day, I felt like every word I said turned into a ridiculous controversy not supported by the facts.
Yeah.
And you know, there's only so much you can do about that. I've always sort of been of the belief that you just have to let that go, because you can't control what the media is going to do and say about you or what people think of you. But when it comes in every other day over the course of, you know, more than a year, it's hard. I'm not going to lie. It was tough on me emotionally. I think in general, I'm of the belief that, you know, life in the public square, if you're doing it right, means loved, hated, never ignored. You know, like, you just have to resign to that, that you'll all have people, you know, scoff at me as I walk down the street, but I'll have far more people come over and want to hug me and tell me they love me. And my kids see both sides. You know, even my little guy, who's now 7, he gets it. You know, he'll see something, a picture of me on a tabloid or whatever, and I'll say, oh, honey, you know, there's lots of lies about mommy out there. And he'll say, well, why don't you correct them? And I'm like, because there's no need. The people who believe that stuff want to believe it. And the people who don't believe it don't need to be persuaded. You know, my fans know who I am, and they don't believe the nonsense. And the other people, in my experience, have been very agenda-driven. They're in a different kind of bubble. There's really no point in fighting those fights. So you kind of have to surrender to it if you're going to put yourself out there as a public figure.
Why the podcast? You are starting a new podcast. We have a lot of people that you're working with who I know are super smart on the business side, and I think you've chosen well there. But why this particular way to reach your audience?
Well, I really wanted to be independent, meaning not have a corporate sponsor above me controlling everything I did and said, you know, the old media, if you will. Because there are pressures. There are pressures to cover the news in a certain way, to not say certain things. And I just don't want to live like that anymore. I'm at a point in my life where I don't want to do that. And I think we're at a point in our country where we need more free agents who are just ready to say what's true.
Amen.
No matter what slings and arrows, right? No matter what slings and arrows come. And I'm in a position to do it now. You know, it's like I've been at ABC, I've been at NBC, I've been at Fox. I've done a lot of things, and I'm ready to just be in control of my own little empire. And honestly, if we start with 10 listeners, great. Maybe the next week we'll have 12. And over time, I will build up my relationship again with my audience, who I do believe is there. I know how they feel. I know there are strong people out there who don't believe in these nonsense safe spaces, who really want to have challenging conversations, who are way tougher than, you know, these media people give them credit for. You know, those are the people I'm going after. And it's great because they have more and more options in podcasting. I think my voice will be additive to the ones that are already out there. And hopefully people remember that I do the news. I bring the news in a way that's user-friendly. But for me, it just made perfect sense because I wouldn't have a corporate master. I could do things the way I wanted to. And I genuinely believe that this is the future, and that, you know, television news is dying. It's yesterday. Digital is the future. And so this is where you should place your bet.
I've got two quick questions for you because I know you're busy. And then I've got a broad question for you at the end, if we can run through really quick, because I jotted down. In general, did you watch Bombshell? And if so, what's it like to have someone as talented as Charlize Theron playing you? Like, most people, you know, jokingly kind of say, I think Wolf Blitzer or somebody was like, hey, if somebody played you in a movie, who would you? Oh, it was Dr. Fauci. He was like, who would you want? And he was like, Brad Pitt. And everybody kind of laughs. Charlize Theron played you. And if you were like a normal, you know, woman sitting out there and you're like, any woman can play you in a movie, a lot of women, especially around your age, my wife's age, would be like, oh, I would love to have Charlize Theron. So did you watch it? And what is it like to have somebody that accomplished inhabiting you in some way?
I did watch it. I wasn't sure if I was going to watch it because I had nothing to do with it. And I was concerned that it was going to be a hit piece, either, I don't know, either about me or my friends at Fox. You know, I still love Fox. I still have a lot of good memories there. And I just knew they'd probably turn it into a parody of people who I really care about. And to some extent, they did. And I really hated what they did to Brian Kilmeade in that movie, just as one example. But I did ultimately watch it. And I wound up actually doing a piece with some of the women who were portrayed in there, whose stories were portrayed. And I posted it on my YouTube channel, if you want to go look it up. it's actually really good, I think. The women were very open about their experience at Fox. But look, it was surreal and it was incredibly emotional. I didn't expect it to be quite that emotional, you know, that I'd have tears running down my face in certain scenes. You know, whenever they showed my kids on the screen, even now, even just telling you about it, it chokes me up. I get that thing in my throat, you know, because it was tough for them too. Like the whole couple of years, Trump and Ailes and all that. It just brought back a lot of painful memories. And of course I'm thinking to myself, there's a reason I repressed all of this. Imagine taking one of the most difficult years or two of your life and then seeing it on the big screen, you know, read back, performed back for you. So it was traumatic in some ways, but overall I felt, you know, the movie was a force for good because it did help shine a light on sexual harassment and how it usually goes down and how tricky it is to navigate. So I'm in favor of that. And, you know, I thought Jay Roach, the guy who directed it and made it happen, was a terrific guy.
So as a part of that, the Me Too movement, sexual harassment, I think, and this kind of ties in with the Duke lacrosse in many ways, the Brett Kavanaugh hearing, and I don't know that I've heard you talk a ton about this, but it fired me up in a really big way as a lawyer, because it was, to me, it was like Duke lacrosse, except in the Senate Judiciary Committee. I don't know what you think about Brett Kavanaugh. I don't know if you've ever met him before. But when you looked at all the evidence there, it, to me, was so transparent that that was a attempt to get him without the goods, so to speak. If you're a lawyer, you look at all the facts and everything else. And what started as something that I think is very reasonable, Me Too, moved to believe all women, which is fundamentally anti everything lawyers are taught, right? If we went to law school and they said, oh, you have to believe the white person, well, that's everything that was wrong with the Jim Crow South and everything before then. And the same thing to me is true of believe all women or believe all Hispanics or all Asians. The only thing that matters is the facts. Were you as troubled by the evolution and how quickly it moved from what may well have been occurring at Fox News with Roger Ailes and many other people in media having to deal with sexual harassment to something with Brett Kavanaugh, which is fundamentally not that, it seemed to me? It was an awkward high school encounter, even if it ever occurred, that I think almost everyone who's ever been 16 or 17 has experienced. And I don't even believe it happened. But even if you accept the allegation on its face, as lawyers often do or judges do, there was no basis to it.
So I, too, felt deeply affected by what happened in that case and was disgusted by the allegations that were thrown at Brett Kavanaugh with zero credible supporting evidence in the case of especially these later ones who came forward. We can talk about Blasey Ford because I put her in a different category. But yes, you go back and take a look at some of my coverage on NBC. There were articles written up about it because, let's just say, I was the lone voice defending Brett Kavanaugh and just holding people to account. There was a guy named Jacob Soboroff who came on my show and said he's now been subjected to 5 allegations of sexual assault. I said, hold on. That's not true. And we went through, I mean, of course I had it at the ready, because as all lawyers do, about exactly what had been alleged. And, you know, creepy porn lawyer, as Tucker would say, Michael Avenatti's client, who was the worst of all of them. And then there was the one that he was counting in there, which was the mother of some woman who may have been Brett Kavanaugh's girlfriend at some point, remembers her daughter saying he threw her against the wall. And the NBC published that account.
Ran with all of it.
Oh, my God. And by the way, the actual daughter, the actual girlfriend later came out and said, that didn't happen. So if somebody had bothered to check with me, you might not have gone out on that limb. But this is how the news works. So you've got this guy, Jacob Soboroff, out there saying 5 allegations of credible assault. Are you kidding me? So, yeah, even while I was on NBC, I was outraged about what was being done to him. I think the Blasey Ford thing is, it's not egregious for the media to report on that, and the facts on that deserve to be heard. Her testimonial, I was fine with her offering that testimonial. My own, you know, personal take as a lawyer on what probably happened there was, you know, the concept in the law of the eggshell plaintiff.
Yes.
And it's basically, you know, some people are I don't want to say that. The weaker is not the word I'm looking for, but
no, the more concept likely for people to, the people out there who are not aware of it, like the thin skull. Like if you accidentally hit somebody who has a thin skull, it's a concept in a plaintiff law. You're responsible for what happens to them, but they can be impacted in a way that would not happen to the average person. Does that make sense?
That's
like
right.
For people, I'm trying to say it to a way for people to understand it.
That's exactly right. So, you know, you don't know who you're going to hit.
Who you're dealing
with. Negligently hit the softball, right? You don't know how tough their skull is going to be. And my impression of her was she was a very fragile person who seemed very, very nervous, very maybe slightly not all together.
Yeah.
And so my impression was this is a girl who may have had some sort of an interaction with a young Brett Kavanaugh. And in her world, it was something significant. And in his world, it was a nothing. And in the average woman's world, it might have been a nothing. And because I have a hard time believing she just totally made it up for political purposes to kill the guy, though I've seen that happen. I don't rule that out. But I think to come with it 30 years later and expect this guy who's had a stellar record on the bench, not a whiff of problematic reports while he's been on the federal bench. In fact, to the contrary, so many female character witnesses, young girls, old women, talking about what an advocate he's been. So nothing credible at all was really unfair because the guy, there was no way he could defend himself. He tried. He had the journals and all that, and nobody remembered her story, including her own friend. Anyway, so that's Blasey Ford. I didn't object to a media vetting of the claim she brought forward. Everyone else, I feel very differently about. It was a huge smear job. It changed the Supreme Court nomination process forever. What the Democrats were doing to Brett Kavanaugh was disgusting and unforgivable. It was unforgivable. The fact that they accused him of gang rape from this Julie Swetnick's allegations, which were completely and obviously bogus from day one. Was disgusting. And the fact that they would run with an allegation like that at places like NBC, but wouldn't run the Harvey Weinstein rape stories that Rose McGowan was on the record with and other women were on the record with NBC, that's just one of the media that dropped the ball on it, is egregious, right? It just tells you everything you need to know about bias. They protect the guy, the rich guy. He's donated to all the Democrats, and, you know, he makes legal threats. So, okay, peace out. By the way, they have their own, you know, predator inside the halls at NBC, as it turned out, which, according to Ronan, was exactly why they didn't want to tell the story of Harvey Weinstein. But as long as it's a Republican nominee to the Supreme Court, have at him. Go for it, Julie Swetnick. Michael Avenatti, how many times can we put you on television? Anyway, to me, it was a travesty, and we're gearing up for another one.
That's what I was going to say. We're talking before. This is not going to go up till next week, but how much of a mess do you think this next... And I guess what I should say, because you got me fired up too, these are theoretically some of the brightest legal minds in politics that are on the Senate Judiciary Committee sitting as Democrats, right? And I watched those hearings and I just thought to myself, how in the world could you ever think this makes sense as an objective lawyer? Right? The way that so many of those Democrats behaved. And I would like to think that Republicans on the Senate Judiciary Committee wouldn't behave the same way. We may have to wait a few years to find out. But to me, the precedent that the Kavanaugh hearing set is effectively no one is eligible to be a Supreme Court justice because everybody's got something that somebody negative can say about them, even if it doesn't rise to the level of being criminal.
Well, that's the thing, is like people are taking a hard look at Coney Barrett saying, oh, they're going to come after her for her faith or, you know, for this ruling or for that ruling. They're going to come after anyone. If I were Trump, I would pick who I genuinely want. You know, I'd pick the one who'd give me the best legacy on the bench with the rulings I hope for, right? That who's going to be an institutionalist and originalist and represent, you know, my worldview when it comes to law the best possible. Because whoever it is going to get killed unfairly by the press, and by the Democrats. And
I think you'll
say,
do
you're
it.
More generous than I am. I don't look at those Democrat lawyers and think these are some of the best legal minds in the country. I really don't. There's very few people who.
I said for politicians, they're some of the best legal minds, right? I mean, that's the best of the elected officials, unfortunately, that have law degrees that we could rely on. And I just sat there disgusted. I mean, I couldn't believe what I was seeing.
That's why the Lindsey Graham moment was so huge.
So powerful.
We all watched, and I covered at length, wall-to-wall, gavel-to-gavel, the Supreme Court confirmation hearings in recent history of John Roberts, of Samuel Alito, of Elena Kagan, of Sonia Sotomayor. None of this happened. There was like a little, Alito got a little bit unfairly beat up, and his wife shed a tear, right? It was like a sad moment in the process. That's it. And that was already more vicious than it used to be, other than Bork. And to see them try to destroy this man, destroy him without any concern for the truth, for what would be admissible in a court of law, what's appropriate to report to an audience of millions, was infuriating. And so I think we're going to see it again. I don't know how to solve it. I think it's like a nuclear arms race now, where no one's going to step down. Each side just keeps raising the ante. Although, all I can hope is that, because I think Trump's going to fill a seat, and I think he's going to get his vote, and I think he's going to install the next justice on the Supreme Court. And I don't think the Democrats, I don't believe they're going to pull the trigger on
stacking the court.
I can't believe they'd do that. It's that is killing the Supreme Court. The Supreme Court's done if they do that. It's over.
By the way,
would they possibly go that far?
Yeah, I can't imagine. I was just going to say, if you want to read about that, there's a fantastic book by Molly Hemingway called Justice on Trial, The Kavanaugh Confirmation and the Future of the Supreme Court. It goes all the way through. It's an incredible book. Molly Hemingway, I want to make sure I get it right, and Carrie Severino did a phenomenal job on that. All right, I've kept you for a long time. Final question here, because I'm always kind of curious. This is the Wins and Losses podcast. I'm Clay Travis. We've been talking with Megyn Kelly. And by the way, this is fantastic. I want to bring you on to talk when this process actually starts playing out on the Supreme Court. I feel like it's going to be covered so poorly that I'm already fired up about just wanting to have a panel of smart lawyers who aren't trying to come at this from I'm not telling you who I think should be on the Supreme Court, right? I'm not the president. I probably would disagree with many of the rulings that Brett Kavanaugh would make, or Sonia Sotomayor for that purpose, whoever you want to point to, right? But Brett Kavanaugh was eminently qualified and probably as good of a choice as Donald Trump could make, right? If you're acknowledging that the Republican is going to make the choice, I think Amy Coney Barrett, based on everything that I know about her and have researched, is an eminently reasonable choice. This isn't George Bush trying to put Harriet Myers on the court because he's good friends with her. You know, this is an eminently reasonable choice. And I just feel like the media, by and large, is going to do such an awful and crappy job of covering this that I feel like there has to be an outlet that can do a good job of it. Now, I'm sure you'll do a good job of it on your podcast, but I feel like that's being lost.
No, I couldn't agree more. And it did occur to me, you know, for the purposes of my launching this podcast, it was good timing, you know, to have this battle.
No doubt.
I do respect the work of Ruth Bader Ginsburg, for the record. I do think she was a liberal icon. She was a fighter for women. I refer not to what she did on the bench, but what she did as an advocate prior to that and at Harvard and coming up in a man's world. So, respect. And I loved her friendship with Scalia. And they were an example in bipartisanship. But this battle is going to require objective, fair voices out there where people know they can turn for the truth. And I know you're one of them, and I will be too, just as soon as I get this thing launched the week of the 28th.
We will be listening. All right, final question. What do you wish you could go back and tell yourself when you walked out of the law firm and into your media career that would have helped you the most to be prepared for what was to come?
Wow. I might have said, you just turn back in there, girl. Don't go.
go be a partner. You can become really successful there. And, you know, at some point you can ride off into the sunset. I mean, I got a lot of friends who have stayed in the partner life and they're doing well. And the positive with that is you grind and it's a tough, tough job. But by and large, you don't have to worry about waking up and pulling out your phone and somebody is, you know, somebody has come after you and you're trending, you know, on Twitter.
I tell you on that front, the difference between your adversary coming after you in the practice of law, in my experience, and those who come after you as, you know, in this profession, in media, is the lawyers still have honor. They do. Not all of them, but for the most part, lawyers still have honor, in my experience, and they won't try to hurt you unfairly. That's not the case in media. Their business is to be unfair and unfactual in today's day and age. And so, as frustrating as that can be, it is. Like, that's our reality, and one just now has to learn how to navigate around it. And then, unfortunately, help people who aren't in the media learn to navigate around it, because they also live in a world of Facebook and Twitter where things are just said about them that aren't true. And now they have to pussyfoot around every issue when they're at their jobs, lest they lose them, you know? And so, I don't know. I just think the call is greater than ever to do what we're doing. But sure, I think in some ways my life would have been easier had I just taken that partnership and tried a bunch of cases and retired with, you know, I guess in 15 more years with a fat pension of some sort. Listen, I'll leave you with this because I've mentioned my therapist several times. She's amazing. After one of the many blow-ups in my life, we were talking, and he said, "You know, Megan, you don't always have to take the path of most resistance." And I thought, you know, if you know me at all, you know that I do. Some of us are just pugilistic by nature, and for whatever reason, the flame finds us. And I think that's brought great, great gifts into my life and some downsides as well. But on balance, I wouldn't trade any of it.
This has been phenomenal. This has been fantastic. I would encourage all of you to go make sure that you subscribe to Megyn Kelly's new podcast. Go follow her on Twitter at Megyn Kelly. I'll tweet out the link. If you haven't followed her already, you can make sure you do it just in time for the Supreme Court confirmation battle that appears. It's going to be imminent on the next few days. Megyn, thank you so much. I know how busy you are. This was phenomenal. Look forward to being able to talk sometime again down the line.
Thanks, Clay. I appreciate it.
That is Megyn Kelly. I am Clay Travis. This has been Wins and Losses.
Be sure to catch live editions of Outkick, the coverage with Clay Travis, weekdays at 6 a.m. Eastern, 3 a.m. Pacific.
This is Malcolm Gladwell from Revisionist History. eBay Motors is here for the ride. With some elbow grease, fresh installs, and a whole lot of love, you transformed 100,000 miles and a body full of rust into a drive that's all your own. Brake kits, LED headlights, whatever you need, eBay Motors has it. And with eBay Guaranteed Fit, it's guaranteed to fit your ride the first time, every time, or your money back. Plus, at these prices, you're burning rubber, not cash. Keep your ride or die alive at ebaymotors.com. Eligible items only. Exclusions apply.
So I know you've got a lot going on, but remember, I'm here for you. So bother me when no one's listening, because I will. Bother me when it feels like it won't get better, because it can. Bother me because you're never a bother. Whether it's a low point or a crisis, get help for yourself or a friend. Learn more at neverabother.org or call or text 988, available 24/7.
What's up, everybody? This is Stephen A. Smith, host of the Stephen A. Smith Show podcast. Tune in every Monday, Wednesday, and Friday at the very least as I bring you all new episodes that feature the biggest headlines in the world of sports, pop culture, business, and I answer your phone calls and respond to your tweets. You'll hear my unfiltered opinions and straight-shooter interviews with top celebrities and game changers, all that and more. So listen to the Stephen A. Smith Show podcast on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.